lockout, so that was locking had brought employees to their heels by, if a company wouldn't deal with him or pay an increase, he would get his members in other companies to refuse to handle the goods of that company, so they'd have to cave in. So Murphy simply said, well, if we're faced with an ultimatum, instead of caving in, what we should do is we should lock out these workers.
I think you could say that it was a clash between two rising classes, if that's not too doctrinaire, between, say, a newly organised working class and a rising Catholic middle class.
The employers were actually united across the sectarian divide. In Dublin, you had, say, the majority of employers were probably Protestant, but Protestant and Catholic employers did come together and presented a very solid front. In fact, the only significant employer who sort of broke ranks with them and stood out against them was a man called Edward Lee, who ran a chain of drapery stores. This was, to some extent, a clash of personalities, that if Murphy and Larkin hadn't been in the same city at the same time, in these circumstances, there may not have been a lockout. Willie Walsh, the Archbishop of Dublin, who's a much neglected figure now, but was a very major figure in modern Irish history. Walsh had actually persuaded the employers in Dublin and the Trades Council to set up a conciliation board. Now, if it had succeeded, it would have been the first conciliation body in the history of these islands that was based on a particular city or geographical area. It got to the stage where the employers had actually nominated their members on the board. I think one of the reasons why he got so far was that Murphy usually was quite ill for a large part of the early part of 1913. But when he came back to work, he found that Larkin had organised on a large scale in one of his main companies, the Dublin United Tramway Company. And he started to purge those workers from the company. Anyone in the transport union or suspected of membership was sacked. And that was the dispute that actually led to the lockout. But if it hadn't been for that, there would have actually been a conciliation machine established, 30 years before the Labour Court was set up in Dublin, which could maybe have resolved that dispute or at least prevented it from spreading. But that didn't happen. Walsh, who had dealt with many people from Parnell to Lloyd George, two people he couldn't handle were Murphy and Larkin, and the two men, it was very much a personal struggle as well as a class struggle.
The other background, I think, that comes across very strongly in your book is that just as the lockout is raging, Ireland is on the cusp of home rule. Can you talk something about the political situation in Dublin at the time?
The city was quite a complex place, and it was an incubator for all sorts of ideas, not just socialist but nationalist in nature, which were to some extent competing with each other all the time. But in the lockout, what happened was you had an alignment of socialists, of suffragettes, of radical nationalists, of basically everybody who had an interest in overturning the accepted regime for one reason or another on one side, and you had established religion and employers and more privileged groups in society on the other. And it's a myth cultivated very successfully for all sorts of reasons by various people, that the workers, had everybody on their side and the employers were a sort of arrogant oligarchy dependent on the British. That's not true. I mean, the reality is that the British did intervene on the side of the employers simply because by maintaining law and order in the city, you would automatically interfere on the side of the employers. But the vast majority of middle-class Dubliners also supported the employers. I mean, there was a lot of money collected in the city for what was called the Loyal Tramway Workers Fund. These were strike breakers who were already earning a good wage, breaking the strike. And there was a large amount of money collected for them in Dublin, whereas there was very little money collected for the relief of distress caused by the lockout. The reason the lockout survived for so long was the massive support workers in Dublin got from workers in England and Scotland and Wales. That was where the vast bulk of their support came from financially. And there was well over £100,000 donated from those from Britain by other workers to support them. So there was massive support from Britain. There was largely antagonism from fellow Dubliners and the country at large. The MPs for Dublin, some of them like William Field, an old Parnellite, were relatively supportive of the workers, but didn't say very much because they were afraid of coming out in case they offended the more reactionary colleagues. And so the Irish Party basically said nothing about the lockout. What little they did say, what little Redmond said, was quite hostile towards the workers. I think that was an important factor in undermining support for the Irish Party in Dublin well before the First World War began to erode it seriously.
What are the forces of law and order in Dublin in 1913?
Well, basically, it's the Dublin Metropolitan Police, which gives the impression that they're some sort of local police force. And in fact, the ratepayers had to contribute towards their upkeep. But the Dublin Metropolitan Police, like the Royal Irish Constabulary, were actually under the direct control of Dublin Castle, not under the control of the corporation at all. So they were sort of a cross between the RIC, which was really an armed gendarmerie that could be used as a paramilitary force and had been used in that capacity during the Fenian uprising of 1867, for example, if you like, an ordinary English-type police force, which was unarmed and which maintained order in more traditional ways. Now, they came under ferocious pressure during the lockout. I think there were something over 20,000 police escorts, for example, conducted during the lockout. A large number of their members were injured during the lockout and were seriously enough injured to be on sick leave for a good part of the time. And sick leave in those days was something that was pretty hard to get. I mean, you would literally have to be, you know, have an arm hanging off before you'd be allowed sick leave. So it meant that they had suffered significant injuries. The pressure was very great on them, and they'd been, many of them, on continuous duty dealing with riots. And in those days, police canteens or police stations in Dublin had what they called wet canteens. In other words, they served alcoholic beverages, usually porter, usually Guinness. When you read reports of DMP constables and RIC constables smelling of drink or being drunk, in fact, during some of the riots in the summer of 1913, the reality is, yes, they were drinking, because the only place they could go and get something to eat between shifts was usually in their canteens because of the hostility or the problems in the city. So they were very much isolated by their role in the lockout from working class communities, and at the same time there was no great appreciation of what they were doing amongst middle class. Middle classes would have looked down on them as really another form of worker, barely more respectable than the people who were causing all the trouble, and they'd be seen merely as hired hands. So their social status was quite low. They hadn't had a pay increase since 1881. In fact, some of the tramway workers on strike were earning more than some of the policemen. So they were not particularly well paid or regarded. And also, they were largely excluded from promotion. The Freemasons were very strong amongst Protestant members of the DMP, and promotion to the higher ranks was almost impossible for Catholics. A few broke through the barrier, but not many. So there were not a lot of things going for you apart from job security, if you're a member of the DMP. And their role in the lockout antagonised workers. It mightn't have mattered that much. I mean, obviously the same thing happened during industrial disputes in Britain. It wouldn't have mattered that much if it hadn't been for the fact that very shortly after the lockout you had a whole series of other events leading to 1916 rising, the War of Independence and so on, which meant that the bad blood that existed as a result of the lockout was never cleared, was never cured. That resentment carried through, and in fact it's interesting that one of the detectives who was shot in the War of Independence was one of the principal, a guy called Dick Revel, was one of the main note takers in the at meetings of during the lockout, and actually was the principal prosecution witness against Larkin when he was tried for sedition, I think, in October 1913. And Revel actually survived. He was shot 5 times, but he survived, and he spent the remainder of the War of Independence basically as a prisoner in Dublin Castle. But in a way, he personifies the way in which the DMP had become isolated from the wider community in the city.